may have subsided, but storm-caused problems didn't let up Monday.
It's been windy. There have been big waves. We have had trees down.
Their belongings in garbage bags. Neighbors flee their flooded homes at Arbor Mobile Home Park.
And if you look behind me here, there is a massive landslide. This whole hillside came cascading down.
Okay, well, it's dry for now. California is beginning to assess the damage from weeks of severe storms, along with the mudslides, sinkholes, downed trees, and fatal flooding that came with them. At least 19 people have died as a result of these storms. And the damages are estimated to top $1 billion. President Biden is planning to visit Central California later this week to view the damage. For a look into flood insurance and who qualifies for it, let's bring in Mark Friedlander. He is the Director of Corporate Communications at Insurance Information Institute, and that's a nonprofit national organization that helps people get a better understanding of insurance and how they qualify for it. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, how many people in California have flood insurance, private or otherwise?
The flood insurance rate in California is very low. It's only about 2%, which is about half of the national rate, which is only 4%. We look at flood insurance in California and across the country as one of the largest insurance gaps that consumers have today, lack of coverage.
Okay, why do they have a lack of coverage?
Many people don't think they need coverage because they're not in a FEMA-designated floodplain, or many homeowners think that their standard home insurance policy already protects them from floods, which is not the case. Flood insurance is always a separate policy that you need to purchase either through FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program or one of dozens of private flood insurers that now sell the product.
Okay, well, let's talk about those two separate avenues. So looking at the government insurance program under FEMA, is it less expensive than a private insurance plan?
You'd have to price it. In fact, FEMA recently implemented a new rating program called Risk Rating 2.0, which is an actuarially sound approach to rating risk. So they rate risk based on each individual property. And it's pretty much in line with the private insurers now in terms of the way they rate risk. So the cost might be fairly similar. The big difference, though, is you may be able to get a much more robust policy with a private insurer because they offer different limits. Mm-hmm. FEMA has a restriction on their limits. They have a cap of $250,000 for the structure of your home and $100,000 for possessions, such as your clothing, your electronics, your furniture. Many of the private insurers offer much higher limits.
Ah, okay. And does it cover what we saw this past couple of weeks, just endless rain? I'm wondering what these kinds of policies cover and don't cover when it comes to this new form of rain that we're seeing here, these endless atmospheric rivers.
Not only have we seen this in California, but other parts of the country have seen breakout of major rain events over the past few years, areas that typically don't see heavy rain. It doesn't take an atmospheric river. That just makes it a much worse situation than it would be just from a heavy rainstorm. The good news, though, is if you have flood insurance, you are protected from these kind of losses. You want to plan ahead and make sure you have the means in place to protect your assets. In most cases, your home is your largest asset. You want to protect that. And unfortunately, with so few California homeowners having flood insurance, it's going to be very devastating for many Californians.
Right. And so it would cover this heavy rain. What if it's some mud that's gotten into your house?
Well, mudslides, different category. You need a different type of coverage typically for mudslides. And that's typically an earth movement policy similar to earthquake coverage. But, you know, what's considered a mudslide would typically be a separate type of scenario, not necessarily a flood event.
So you basically need a different policy for every possible natural disaster. It seems like here in California, earthquakes, fire, floods, mudslides, that can get pretty pricey.
It can. Although, you know, we look at the average cost of a national flood insurance program policy in California. It's fairly reasonable. In fact, it's about 20% less than the U.S. average. So it's running about $800 or so for the average flood policy in California versus $1,000 nationally. For, you know, roughly $70 a month or less, you get very substantial coverage. We know many families do not have the disposable income to purchase all of these coverages. You have to look at, should I spend $800 on flood insurance, or could I afford to pay a $50,000 or $100,000 property loss to my home from a flood?
So a lot of California, or a lot of the urban areas in California, are not in a federally designated flood zone. These designations were made many, many years ago. Is it time to update them?
Here's our take. If it rains at your home, it could flood and you should be protected as best as possible. Don't rely on just the FEMA maps, because we've seen catastrophic flooding events in areas across the country just in the last year. Midwest states that have never had anything like what they saw in summer of 2022. So you need to think about, how do I fully financially protect my property and my family? Talk to your agent, get a few quotes, see if you could find an affordable level of coverage that will protect you much better from these hazards.
What if you rent though?
Say you're a renter, you're on the 10th floor, you don't need to worry about flood coverage in California. It's not going to
happen. If you rent
a
house, for example.
But if you rent a house, or if you're a first floor renter in an apartment complex, you could buy flood insurance for a rental, and it's much less than a home, just a few $100 per year, and you could have flood coverage add on to your renter's policy as well.
All right. Mark Friedlander, Director of Corporate Communications at the Insurance Information Institute. That's a nonprofit national organization that helps people get a better understanding of insurance. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me today. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, what is the difference between President Biden and former President Trump when it comes to the classified documents found at their homes? The League Legal is here to explain next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Last year, President Biden had harsh words for his predecessor after we learned former President Trump took classified documents to Mar-a-Lago.
How that could possibly happen? How anyone could be that irresponsible?
Well, over the weekend, we learned there were more documents found at Biden's home in Delaware. It's still nowhere near the hundreds of papers discovered at Trump's Florida home. But White House and Department of Justice officials unearthed the additional materials the same day Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel to investigate. It's similar, but still very different from what Trump is accused of. And we're going to talk about the distinction now with Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and our regular League Legal here on Press Play. Hello.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So neither of these men should have had these documents. Let's just get that out of the way. So what is the law surrounding that? Why can't they have these documents in their private possession?
That's a great question, because they were either the president or the vice president, and at the time they could have the documents. So why can't they leave with them? And the answer is that under the Presidential Records Act, which also includes the vice president, those documents belong to us. They don't belong to Joe Biden or Donald Trump. They are government documents and they belong to the public. So they should be housed at the National Archives. And if they're classified, they should be stored the proper way.
So if they do remove these top secret documents, what is the penalty for that?
Yeah, this is the question. And the answer is, it really depends on two things. For any sort of criminal penalty, you need an intent or at least knowledge satisfaction. Basically, you need to show that President Biden knew he was taking the classified documents. He knew it was unauthorized and he was putting them in a place that he shouldn't put them. I'm being very general here, but it can't be an accident. There has to be something called scienter, knowledge or intent. The other thing with respect to President Biden is, he's the sitting president, and we know that you don't indict a sitting president. all a way of saying, what are the potential penalties here? At this point for President Biden, I don't see any, because I don't see the scienter requirement unless more evidence comes out. And he's still the sitting president. Different story when it comes to former President Trump, where based on the evidence, we could say he knew what he was doing. He intended to engage in this behavior. And so much so that we're even talking about potential obstruction, not just a violation of the Presidential Records Act and maybe even something like the Espionage Act, but also obstruction because he was asked for those documents over and over again.
Right. And that is the key difference in these two cases, right? It was actually President Biden's lawyers who turned over the documents before anyone knew about them and could execute an FBI search warrant, as opposed to former President Trump, who repeatedly refused to turn them over and then had to be subjected to an FBI search.
I think that is exactly right. There's a reason that the FBI was able to get that search warrant and execute the search warrant, because the government had asked over and over again for the documents. And because there was evidence that former President Trump's lawyers actually lied to the Department of Justice and said, you have everything. It turns out that they didn't have everything. You know, other differences here are the fact that there's a huge disparity in the number of documents. That in and of itself is important, but it also shows, again, that lack of intent, that lack of knowledge, the fact that a few classified documents, which of course is a few too many, were mixed in with other documents, is part of a whole narrative that shows lack of desire to break the law.
So what is the evidence in terms of intent when it comes to Donald Trump?
So when it comes to Donald Trump, the evidence of intent here, I think, is in part how he dealt with documents while he was president, what he said to aides when his documents were being packed up and he was leaving the presidency, the fact that he was asked for these documents over and over again, and he either didn't give everything over or his lawyer lied and said, you have everything. The fact that there's security footage reportedly showing one of his aides moving documents before and after that subpoena was issued, all of that goes to show intent. Again, with respect to President Biden, there was no pending request. I don't think anyone, frankly, knew these documents were missing. It's really, I mean, for people who check out library books, for instance, it's the difference between opening your purse or your briefcase, finding a library book, running back to the library versus seeing that book and saying, nope, I don't have anything at all. And again, not just talking about one book and not talking about the same book.
But with the caveat that we really don't know yet, this is also new, if there was any intent to take these documents and use them for their private purposes. We really don't know yet.
That's exactly right. Unless you have that smoking gun where you have an email or a text message or a recorded conversation or somebody testifying to a conversation where they say, the president told me I want these classified documents, then what you're doing is you're looking at the evidence surrounding these circumstances to try and surmise intent or knowledge. And again, just based on what we know now, very, very different stories between these two men.
Okay, so just one final question. If it is proven that on the part of Donald Trump, there was criminal intent to remove these documents, what are the penalties?
So at this point, you could actually face not just a monetary penalty, but if they're able to show criminal intent, it depends on the statute, but you could be looking at years in prison. These are serious charges. Again, it depends on what statute. If it's the obstruction statute, the espionage statute, the Presidential Records Act, and which section there's a charge. But it's not necessarily just what we've seen in the past for presidential advisors where they pay a penalty. You could be facing prison time for a violation.
Jessica Levinson is our legal here on Press Play. She also teaches at Loyola Law School. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Republicans want to investigate President Biden for that. And his son, Hunter, coming up, will take an in-depth look into what Hunter Biden did and did not do.
You know, Hunter's activities, it's not flattering. At times, it's really quite disturbing the closer you look at it. but it's just not the story that they're telling.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Last week, House Republicans began to make good on their long-running promise to investigate President Biden's family and finances. One of their main targets is the president's son, Hunter Biden. They want to look into his past business dealings and how he ended up on the board of a Ukrainian oil company while his father was vice president. He has also faced scrutiny for erratic behavior stemming from his addiction to crack cocaine and alcohol. Hunter says he is now sober, but he is already under a federal investigation for failing to pay a $2 million tax bill, which he eventually paid. Joining me to talk about all this is Adam Entes. He's part of a team at the New York Times that wrote a big investigation into what's true and what's untrue about the Republicans' allegations against the president's son. Welcome to Press Play.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, what exactly are Republicans claiming Hunter Biden and his dad have done wrong to warrant this investigation?
Well, the first part of it is the part that has the grain of truth to it, which is that Hunter did serve on the board of this Ukrainian gas company, and he did get paid a lot of money. And it's hard to argue that he didn't get that position because of who his father was, right?
This is Burisma.
That's the famous
Burisma that we heard about during the first impeachment of former President Trump.
That's right. And so, you know, obviously that's true, right? You know, Hunter was paid a lot of money to be on that board. What the Republicans then go further, though, they then say that Joe Biden himself was involved, right? That Joe Biden himself, knew about this, was benefiting from it. And as you know, from that period in 2019, they were claiming that that Joe Biden intervened in Ukrainian politics to protect his son. That was the unsubstantiated allegation back then. What you have is a common theme here, which is, you know, Hunter's activities, it's not flattering. At times, it's really quite disturbing the closer you look at it. But it's just not the story that they're telling, right? Mm-hmm. Where his father was sort of the chairman of his son's global corruption campaign to make money for the Biden family and for Joe Biden himself.
Okay, well, take us back to 2014, and that's when Hunter Biden ends up on the board of Burisma, and his father is vice president of the United States. And through your reporting, as you say, is it pretty clear that he got this job because the head of this company hoped to gain some access to the White House?
I think what you have to keep in mind here is the context, right? Hunter's older brother, Beau, is at this point been diagnosed with brain cancer, which is pretty much a secret, but he's dying, right? And there's financial strain in the Biden household, and Hunter's worried about money. Mm-hmm. And so Hunter at this point has attached himself to another businessman named Devin Archer, who has a lot of experience in international finance. And he ends up meeting the owner of this company, Zlochevsky. He's the oligarch who owns Burisma. After they have this meeting, the oligarch decides to do a background check on Devin Archer. And what it said was, you know, Archer is connected in the Democratic politics through John Kerry, and his business partner is Hunter Biden, the son of the vice president. Mm. What happened is that Hunter goes to Lake Cuomo to attend a conference, and the oligarch kind of surprises him and just kind of shows up, and they do a private walk along the lake, and the oligarch offers him the seat and basically says, you know, we're going to pay you a lot of money to be on this board. And Hunter thinks about it for a few days and decides to do it. He wants the money, right? And he sort of rationalizes taking this position is not going against U.S. government policy in Ukraine, because part of that policy is that Ukraine needs to be more energy independent from Russia. Mm-hmm. But the other part of U.S. policy is an anti-corruption agenda that his own father was pushing, which obviously Hunter tying himself to this oligarch was potentially putting himself, you know, against. Nonetheless, Hunter decided to do it. The positives outweighed the negatives, and he takes the job. And so one of the issues is, His father, you know, based on my reporting, talking to Hunter, talking to White House officials, talking to others around Joe Biden had no idea that Hunter was going to do this. Hmm. And so he calls him up and he says, I hope you know what you're doing. And then Hunter says, I do. But he doesn't say to him, you know, get off that board. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's where there's a kernel of truth in what the Republicans are saying. But it's a big departure from the notion that Joe Biden was part of it and orchestrating it.
OK, so he's on the board. And does he then try to do anything untoward? Does he try to do anything that could be possibly viewed as illegal or at least unethical?
Right. So Hunter writes an email to Devin Archer shortly after he decides to do this, in which he says, you know, like, we have to be careful here. Like, there are rules and laws that I just don't want to deal with, that I don't want to cross these lines. And one of those lines that he enumerated in that email, he didn't want to engage with American officials on behalf of the company or the oligarch who owns it. Certainly, the company, Burisma, wanted Hunter to engage with U.S. officials on their behalf and on behalf of that oligarch in particular to try to address his visa problems, his problems in the United States. But what's clear in the emails is that people around Hunter and Hunter, but his business manager, his other advisors, were basically deflecting those requests. And they ended up hiring others to do that kind of work so that Hunter wouldn't do that kind of work himself. So he gets the money, but he doesn't really do this other stuff. And frankly, he keeps on getting this money even after he becomes addicted to crack cocaine in 2016. Mm-hmm. He's really not doing much work for them, but he is still getting that money. And his father is vice president.
Hmm. How much money did he get all told?
I don't know the exact amount, but he was making approximately $600,000 a year for this, which is a lot of money. But one thing, again, context is important here. He had a very expensive lifestyle in Washington, and that $600,000 a year he got from Burisma did not cover it. And it wasn't just his lifestyle. It was his family's lifestyle. They lived in a house that they really couldn't afford. Him and his wife sent their three daughters to a very expensive private school in Washington. And later, when they got a little older, they went to very expensive universities. And so the costs were very high. Plus, by the middle of 2016, he's a crack addict. You know, he needs mm-hmm. to buy drugs. The rehabs he went to, because you know, the family wanted to keep all this secret. He didn't just go to any rehabs. We're talking $15,000 for 1 week.
Wow.
And so that increases the pressure on him. Not only he didn't want to give up Burisma because he needed the money, but he had to make more money, which meant he had to take bigger risks in order to kind of keep all the balls in the air. And that's sort of what was going on. That's where he gets into trouble.
So what are these bigger risks? Because he's also involved in a failed deal with a Chinese private investment fund.
So there's sort of two China deals here. One of them is a venture that starts earlier around 2013, 2014, which really just kind of never pans out, partly because of the public scrutiny that it received later on. And that was about taking money, Chinese government money, and investing it in American companies and infrastructure. That's the first one. He's sober at that point. When he does Burisma, he's sober. So in other words, you can't use the drug thing to excuse his decision-making there, right?
Yeah.
Now, fast forward to 2017. He's using crack all the time. His wife is no longer with him. His business manager is gone. All these people that were sort of his safety net are gone. He's really by himself now. He's trying to keep all these balls in the air, and he goes down the path. Yeah.
And when you say he's doing crack all the time, what do you mean by that? Like every day, all day long?
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind he is occasionally in and out. It's one of these cycles, right? He has a period of incredibly heavy drug use, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a few months. And then maybe he has a few weeks when he's gone back to rehab and he's clean, right? And then he relapses again. It's the cycles that he's in. And when, you know, I mean, you could tell actually if reading closely in the emails, you can tell when he's sober because his emails are actually written coherently, right? There's fewer spelling mistakes. when he is using, suddenly it's like broken English kind of stuff, right? Very mm-hmm. sloppy. And so in 2017, to get back to the business stuff, you know, he's using a lot, he's using drugs a lot. He didn't pay his taxes. He doesn't pay it again in 2018. He really needs to get money. And he was approached about this tycoon, this Chinese tycoon, who was at the time running this multi-billion dollar Chinese energy company, who kind of, you know, seemed like he wanted to attach himself to Hunter. Keep in mind, the same tycoon was attaching himself to Republicans as well, including some Republicans, you know, that had that were close to Donald Trump. So Hunter enters these negotiations with him. And in the summer of 2017, they reach an agreement on a joint venture. Approximately $5 million is transferred to set up this joint venture. And when this happens, Hunter is obviously excited. He thinks he's hit the payday, right? This is going to solve all of his problems. But there are some weird things that start happening. Maybe weird, it's not the right word, but I see them as weird. The oligarch pulls Hunter aside at one point and tells him that he's concerned that one of his underlings is under investigation from the Justice Department and the FBI. Hmm. And he later was charged and sentenced and convicted for being involved in an international corruption scheme. And what happens is the tycoon flies back to China after the arrest of his underling, and he is picked up later by Chinese authorities that reportedly for corruption. And that deal that Hunter wanted disappears, and he's basically back again, heavily using crack, and his financial prospects are appear to be in ruins. And this is like in a period when his father was considering at that point entering the race to run against Trump in 2020.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. And so where does the gun and the laptop figure into all this? Because we do hear so much about Hunter Biden's laptop and the fact that he bought a gun under false pretenses, if you will, that he bought a gun and said that he wasn't on drugs, but he was.
Right. So this is a period that's occurring. It's roughly happens within a 6-month period. In kind of the fall of 2018 and early 2019, Hunter just lost this Chinese deal that he thought was going to save him. He's really in a complete free fall in that period of 2018. You know, he came out of rehab. He did one more rehab stint, and it's not really clear, you know, based on my interviews with his friends and associates, and based on the close reading of those emails, whether that stuck for very how long that rehab kept him sober. It's not clear. Bottom line is that in October of 2018, he loses his phone. He goes to an AT&T store in Wilmington to get a new one. And literally across the street from that place is a gun store. And for reasons that are unclear, he decides to buy a 38 handgun. And there is a form he had to fill out when he bought that gun. And one of the questions on the form was, are you using controlled substances, right? And he answers no. And he tells friends that when he writes no, when he checks no in the box there, he believed that he was sober. Whether he was or not, I do not know. And so because of his addiction issues, it's really hard to know, you know, how intentional his behavior was, right? Mm-hmm. The same thing could be applied to the taxes. He doesn't file his taxes. That's undeniably true. But did he mean not to file his taxes, or was he just out of his mind?
And he ended up paying the taxes back, right? He got a loan from someone here in Los Angeles and paid the $2 million.
Yeah, that's like after his father is president. Right. So, you know, in 2021, he does that payment. Now, you asked about the laptop. So, you know, to be honest, it's similar to this gun purchase period. It's in this sort of period in Hunter's life where it's sort of like a blur, if you will. Is he sober this day or is he using that day? It's really hard to know. So the Republican story here is that he takes a laptop or laptops and goes to this repair shop in Wilmington and drops it off and never picks it up, right? Mm-hmm. I have no idea if that is true. You know, I have tried to figure that out. It's really hard to determine where he was on that day. The bottom line is that his emails were taken either because he left the laptop there or because he was hacked. You know, I don't know what happens, right? But the bottom line is that a lot of his data is taken. And, you know, I've gone through, you know, I would say tens of thousands of those emails.
Are they public? Are they available for anyone to see?
Yeah, there are a few websites that are sort of affiliated with one former Trump official who created a website, which he says is nonpartisan, but I don't know. I don't know how he, you know, I don't know what the basis of that is. But anyways, bottom line is there are a few places you can go on the internet. Obviously, the New York Post and some others have published large quantities of this. But, you know, frankly, it's a very what's been publicized is a very selective curating, if you will, of the data. And if you really kind of go through it day by day, you actually get this picture that we're trying to describe, which is really somebody who's kind of in and out of rehab, you know, in and out of sobriety. He's just not really thinking all that clearly. And he's sort of careening into things. And he begins to, he meets a woman named Melissa Cohen, who becomes his second wife. They have sort of this very quick romance. And he begins to sober up. And, you know, he's sort of emerging from this fog, if you will, of the heavy drug use. And he's trying to basically figure out what the hell just happened, you know, realizing kind of the wreckage of his addiction period and trying to dig himself out from under it.
Gosh, it really is a tragic story. And in the Greek sense of the word, if you will, I mean, it's really sad. And the fact is that he is going to be the center of attention, negative attention, for the next 2 years, at least.
Yeah. I think for as long as his father is running for president or is president, there will be this sharp eye of attention on him, right? The visibility we have into his life is extraordinary, right? We don't have that of Jared Kushner or anybody else in a similar sort of position. And so it does provide an opportunity for us to try to get to the bottom of these things and try to figure out what's real, right? Which is, by the way, let me stress, the true story of Hunter Biden is not a flattering story, right? It's just not the story the Republicans are presenting when it comes to Joe Biden's involvement, as best as we can tell, based on the evidence we have available to us, again, of the level of Joe Biden's involvement in any of this, which, as best I can tell, was sort of, you know, sometimes his business associates would encounter Joe Biden, but the encounters are all very superficial based on my interviews with the people who were in those meetings, right? Or in those encounters.
So from what you've determined, there was no influence peddling with his dad. In fact, when it's all boiled down, the U.S. attorney in Delaware is looking at just a couple of possible charges, lying on that gun permit and not paying his taxes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, as best I can tell, based on the evidence that I have, you know, it's almost like the opposite of the story that the Republicans are saying. Like Hunter was actually with Holt trying to keep his father out of all this stuff, but he was sloppy about it. And his father, who was really worried about him, you know, the fear after Bo dies, after his older brother dies, you know, Hunter was told at least one very close friend, you know, I know you all think the wrong son died, right?
And so
this is a guy who, you know, I think many people in the family and their close friends, they were worried about suicide. And so if you're the dad of a son like that, and you know he's going through an incredibly hard time, because Joe Biden wants to be around his son whenever that opportunity presents itself, sometimes there are these other people around. And that's where you have the liabilities that happen that the Republicans have seized upon, because there's a dinner here, there's a dinner there, there's a business partner waiting in a rope line at Joe Biden's hotel that happens to be working with Hunter on a business deal in China. Over and over and over again, you have these encounters. And so it did create this liability, which is undeniable, and these questions, and it's very hard to know because, you know, journalists weren't there. I wasn't there to know for sure what was said. And so that's the issue.
Adam Entis, investigative reporter for the New York Times, where you can read his big investigation into Hunter Biden. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, how Sinead O'Connor became the first big celebrity to be canceled, what led up to that moment in 1992 that ended her career. A new documentary tells that story. I'll speak with the director next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away.
The song Nothing Compares to You, sung by Irish singer-songwriter Sinead O'Connor. It was the number one song in the United States back in 1990. With her shaved head, her yearning eyes, and magical voice, Sinead O'Connor captivated the world. But just 2 years later, in 1992, she went from world-famous pop star to pariah after she criticized the Catholic Church on Saturday Night Live.
In the victory of good over evil. Fight the real enemy.
She's tearing up a photo of Pope John Paul II there. She was protesting child abuse in the church and the secrecy around it. She was really ahead of her times, but at the time, she was effectively blackballed, and as quickly as she became a star, she fell. Now, Sinead O'Connor tells her own story in a new Showtime documentary. It's called Nothing Compares, and the director, Catherine Ferguson, joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hello, Madeline. Lovely to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, so she was only 26 years old at that time.
She was.
And she had just become a star just a few years before. And describe her rocket to stardom. How did she become such a worldwide star so quickly?
Yeah, well, really, she came over to London in 1985 when she was 18. And she was brought over by a record label who gave her a year to kind of rehearse with the band and really develop her first album, which became The Lion and the Cobra. And The Lion and the Cobra became this huge success, both in the UK and in America. And I think it was really off the back of that that everything started to just dramatically build for her in terms of her success. It was really her track Mandinka that seemed to push her career forwards. Yeah, it all just happened extremely fast. I think what was fascinating about Sinead is that she was just very singular, and there's nothing that anyone could really do. There's nobody that they could compare her to, and people were as in awe of her as they were concerned about her. And, you know, she just seemed to be hugely topical for lots of reasons, good and bad. So I think all of that really led to this fame that she suddenly finds herself having by the age of 21.
Really incredible. I want to play more of her music now. And this is from her 1987 song, Troy. And it's from that debut album, The Lion and the Cobra.
We're sitting in the long grass in summer, keeping warm, all the memory, every restless night. We were so young then, we thought that everything we could possibly do was right. And we moved, stolen from our very eyes. And I wondered where you went to, and tell me, when did the light die? You will rise.
So that's a really beautiful, haunting melody, and her voice is just gorgeous. But she's singing about some pretty horrific things. Unless you know what her history is, you might not get it. So can you talk about what she's singing about there?
Troy was written when she was a teenager. And actually what she's talking about is the abuse she suffered at the hands of her own mother And who she said that she would have locked her out in the garden, and or she would have turned the lights off in the house and left her out in the garden as punishment whenever she was a teenager. And the song is very much about this awful episode in Sinead's teenage life. Many people think it's about a man, but it's mm-hmm. it's always, you know, it's about her mother, as a lot of I think a lot of Sinead's songs actually are from that era. You know, she goes on to talk even about her singing of Nothing Compares to You. The tear that she cries most famously in that video is when she thinks about her mother again. So I suppose so much of our film is trying to track that relationship, because so much of the relationship she had with her mother is then what plays out whenever she's, you know, at the peak of her fame.
So her mom, she says in the movie that her mom was physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually abusive. And it was a horrific childhood. And it made her also act out. And then I guess her family didn't know what to do with her. So they sent her away to one of these institutions called the Magdalene Laundries. And this is something that's hundreds of years old. And it's where so-called fallen women were sent to these laundries, which were actually laundries, I guess, run by nuns. But they were to hide young women who had been maybe impregnated or abused in some way. And Sinead was sent to one of these places. Why was she sent there?
Well, she wasn't actually sent to a laundry. She was sent to a reform school that was attached to a historic laundry. Mm-hmm. So by the time she got there in the 80s, it was a school for girls, really, who, you know, had been sent maybe for behavioural problems. She had been sent there because she obviously was deemed to have behavioural problems because of the, you know, the traumatic childhood that she'd suffered. There was a music teacher, Jeanette Byrne, who worked with the girls doing music classes, who witnessed this incredible talent, and they really encouraged her to sing and to find her voice and to write songs. And I think whilst going to this place was obviously quite distressing, and being anywhere close to the laundry side of things was hugely distressing, I think it was a bit of a double-edged sword of an experience, because if she hadn't have ended up there, she may not have gone on the journey that she then did.
Yeah, exactly. And she wouldn't have had so much material, I suppose, to yes. write about and sing about so beautifully. She also was political in other arenas, and you have a clip of her at an awards ceremony. I think it was the Grammys. I'm not sure which year exactly, mm-hmm. but she has put into her shaved head, she's drawn the logo for Public Enemy. And because yes. Public Enemy had boycotted the Grammys that year mm-hmm. because they didn't have a best, I guess they didn't have a hip hop or rap category at the time.
Yes, yes.
And so there she was with this logo in her head, shaved into her head or drawn into her shaved head. And she really took up the fight for Black rights. In fact, when we were talking earlier and playing that clip about her tearing up the photo of Pope John Paul II, she was actually talking about the lack of rights, equal rights for Black people. So can you talk about that side of her? Because I don't think a lot of people are aware that she was actually fighting for racial justice as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I just think Sinead, in every aspect of how she used her voice and her platform, was always to speak out for underrepresented communities. And it was something that she felt strongly about from the very get-go. We have reports from speaking to people that went to school with her or teachers who said that literally, even as a teenager, she'd be the person, you know, speaking out about injustices. And it was just something very innately in her, particularly when she moved away from Ireland and could see the much larger injustices in the world. She certainly took it upon herself to use her privilege and her platform to try and raise awareness. And it was so fabulous talking to Chuck D about that and about that particular performance.
I thought it was like admirable when she put the Public Enemy logo in her head. with Sinead O'Connor, you didn't get the sense that she was just being pretentious or she was fake. It was like, yeah, she seriously has issues with this. This is what's going to drive her artistry. She's committed to that.
She's also wearing her baby Jake's baby girl tied around her waist, which is also a bit of a FU to her to the record label that had previously told her that she should probably abort the child that she's carrying. So Sinead at that very early stage is using the aesthetics of protest in a very unusual way, probably not very often seen before, you know, effort like it, and she was 21 at the time. You know, it wasn't some sort of novelty or pseudo protesting in any way. This was somebody who was actually using their own body to actually speak out from the very, very get go.
Yeah. And also, I don't think a lot of people knew that she had gotten pregnant so young, and the record company wanted her to abort the baby.
Yep.
And this was when she was making The Lion and the Cobra, and she said no, she wanted to keep the baby. And so the picture of her on the cover of that album is just her face, because I didn't want to show her pregnant.
No, absolutely.
So what happened after she, well, after that infamous incident on Saturday Night Live? What happened to her career in the years after that?
Well, I just think she suffered like this shocking backlash, the level of vitriol and hate towards this young 25-year-old from Dublin. It doesn't really make a lot of sense why she's causing that much fury. There's men in Times Square with steamrollers steamrolling over her records. There's horrendous commentary from very well-known people who I won't name, but certainly what then happened, I'd say, is probably one of the earliest mass cancelling of a superstar, probably one of the very first, before people had the chance to stick up for themselves and platforms like social media. She vanishes from being a superstar, and she was a superstar at that point. She pretty much vanishes in a commercial sense.
Yeah.
She, of course, went on to create another 7 critically acclaimed albums and has toured the world extensively, but she's never had that same level of commercial success. But by the sounds of it, and what is she, how she ends the film, again, very articulately, is that she didn't want any of that anyway. So,
But does she regret at all that moment, tearing up that photo, or no?
Not in the slightest, no. Not in the slightest.
Does she seem, in fact, the opposite, that vindicated, because so much of what she had to say actually has become accepted?
Absolutely. I mean, it was quite soon after, a couple of years after, where everything really started to come to light with regards to the issue of the Catholic Church. So absolutely. But she really suffered a huge amount for speaking out about it. She really, really did. And it was just, it's just a very tragic thing, I think, for anybody to go through, to kind of, you know, to have the platform that she did have, and, you know, this huge love around the world and this massive success, and to choose to use that to speak out against the injustices that really matter to her. But for then, for her voice and what she had to say to be so reduced and mocked, and for her to be written off as somebody not to listen to about anything, was incredibly cruel.
Hmm. It's really remarkable that it was just 6 years. Your film focuses on those years, 1987 to 1993. And that was just 6 years of a very long life, and yet so momentous.
I know. And as we've said the whole time, I mean, really, there could be 10 documentaries made about Sinead O'Connor. She's had such a unbelievably dense, colourful, incredible life in many ways. But, you know, for us, it was always very important that we could delve into this era so that we could go into the detail and particularly look way back and look at the cause and effect of why she did what she did in 1993. really that's what our film is about, is trying to like go back to the Ireland that spawned her so that you understand what she did in 1993. Because if you understand that, then everything since makes a lot more sense.
Catherine Ferguson, director of the documentary on Sinead O'Connor called Nothing Compares, and you can see it now on Showtime. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.